lot of large, influential traditional meat companies, which worry that their industry might be about to change. The fact that there have been movements towards banning cultivated meat before it's even on the market indicates just how excited people are by it. Right now, there's quite a lot of mediocre sausages and burgers in the plant-based aisle in your supermarket, but there isn't steaks or pork belly or bacon.
From the first-time founders to the funds that back them, innovation needs different. Our episode partner, HSBC Innovation Banking, is proud to accelerate growth for tech and life science businesses, creating meaningful connections and opening up a world of opportunity for entrepreneurs and investors alike. Discover more at www.hsbcinnovationbanking.com/en-gb. Hello and welcome to the UKTM podcast, a weekly chat with the movers and shakers of the UK tech industry and the destination for all things UK tech related. I'm your host, Jane Wakefield, and this week I am joined by Max Jamilli, the co-founder of Hoxton Farms, a food tech firm that is developing cultivated animal fat as an alternative to plant-based food. Welcome, Max.
Hi, Jane. Great to be here.
Now, that was quite a mouthful. Explain what it is you're doing, because I was very clear to say that you're cultivating animal fat rather than lab-grown meat, which is slightly different, right? So tell me what the sort of aim of the company is.
So, Jane, at Hoxton Farms, we make real animal fat without the animals. We're cultivating a deliciously fatty future by growing real animal fat as an ingredient, which we sell to meat alternatives companies who use it to make meat alternatives that finally look and cook and taste just as good as the real thing, powered by our delicious fat, which makes products smell and sizzle and taste irresistible, just like the real thing.
Now, I'm not a vegetarian, I'm a pescatarian, but I don't eat meat. So I'm not sure how I feel about this because I haven't eaten meat for so long. And I, unlike you, don't mind a lot of plant burgers that are on the market. I get that they're not meat and that's fine with me. But do you think that vegetarians are going to buy into this, or is this not aimed at vegetarians? This is aimed at meat eaters that want something delicious but want to be a bit more aware of the damage they're doing to the planet.
Our product is aimed at everyone, but in particular, Jane, at meat eaters, at flexitarians who are trying to reduce the amount of meat that they eat by switching to meat alternatives. They're trying to do that because they care about their own health and they know that traditional meat isn't always healthy. And they're trying to do that because they care about sustainability, the planet, and also animal welfare. The problem is that to flexitarians, traditional meat tastes a lot better than meat alternatives. Meat alternatives have a disappointing nutrition. They seem ultra-processed. They don't taste very good. They're expensive, and they're not especially sustainable. Now, if you're a vegan or vegetarian, you don't have an alternative, so meat alternatives are great. But if you're a flexitarian, then you're a lot less willing to compromise on all those things when you can go back and eat delicious traditional meat instead. What we're trying to do is use cultivated fat to make meat alternatives that are so good, maybe even better than traditional meat, that when a flexitarian thinks about switching, they don't have to compromise on taste, on nutrition, or on price. And ultimately, when you think about our mission as a sustainability mission, one that helps the planet and helps animals, vegans and vegetarians are a solved problem. They're already not eating traditional meat. Our goal is to close the last factory farm on Earth. And the way that we do that is by appealing to people who right now are eating meat and helping them eat even less of it. They're a much bigger part of the population than the vegans and vegetarians alone.
And it's a huge market. I mean, by some estimates, it could be worth as much as 20 billion by 2013. And we've both talked about the climate impact of meat. Again, some estimates suggest that, you know, moving to meat alternatives could cut the climate impact of meat by more than 90%. So in that respect, it's a clear-cut argument. But it's an area that's not without controversy. Some people have dubbed these alternatives Franken-meat. We're seeing action in the US, in some states, to target lab-grown meat because they're worried about the economic effect it will have on livestock farming. And there's similar battles brewing in Europe. So what are your thoughts on that kind of backlash, as it were, to meat alternatives?
Meat alternatives are certainly causing a stir. And I think that's a good thing because a lot of people know, whichever side of the debate they're on, that meat alternatives are going to make a massive difference. But you're right, there is, in some small sense, a debate. There's been political controversy in the US. There's political controversy in Italy, maybe in other parts of Europe too. A lot of this is driven by the big meat lobby. There are a lot of large, influential, traditional meat companies which worry that their industry might be about to change. Realistically, I think cultivated meat companies and traditional meat companies have many ways to work together and will work together. And the vast majority of interactions between the two industries are really, really positive ones, notwithstanding some relatively minor political stuff that's going on. If anything, the fact that there have been movements towards banning cultivated meat before it's even on the market indicates just how excited people are by it. When it comes to consumer acceptance, eating something new is always a bit of an intimidating prospect for people. Potatoes were first introduced to Europe 500 years ago, and people were terrified of them when they came over the sea from the New World. Now everybody loves potatoes. What we make is, of course, a little bit science fiction at first, but really it's a product of food technology, just like beer or bread or yogurt. And it's a new way of making something that we've been eating for millennia, that is meat. And when people realize in the tastings that we do how delicious it is, how nutritious and safe and good for the planet, then they quickly come to understand the process and they come to love the ingredient. So I think the political issues are a storm in a teacup. They shouldn't be taken lightly, but they're a relatively small part of the story. And consumer acceptance is already going really well, even despite the fact that the industry is still so nascent and barely yet on the market.
And we'll talk a bit about the science fact rather than the science fiction in a bit. But just another question on the regulation, because I see that you are waiting regulatory approval. So what's the kind of situation with the wider meat alternative market in the UK? And what are the specifics of the regulation that you're waiting on?
So meat alternatives is a broad church. There are meat alternatives made entirely from plant-based ingredients. There are meat alternatives made from what's called precision fermentation, which uses microbes like bacteria or yeast to make food. And for example, corn has been doing that process for a very long time. And then there are meat alternatives made using cultivated meat or fat. And that's real cells from animals that we eat, just grown in a facility instead of a farm. Whatever the new food, if a food is something that hasn't been eaten before by the general population, it needs to go through what's called novel foods approval. And that applies whether it's an ingredient for a chocolate bar or an ingredient for incredible world-changing cultivated meat like we make. In the UK, this is done by the Food Standards Agency. The Food Standards Agency is newly independent from its European counterpart, EFSA, since Brexit, and therefore still working out how exactly to approve cultivated meat and cultivated fat. We've been working really closely with the FSA. They often visit us. We're really enjoying collaborating with them to lay down a regulatory process so that over the next few years, we will be able to give them all of the detailed data about our process and our product that they need. And they will be able to work on getting our ingredient approved so that we can use it in the UK. More broadly, several countries have already moved towards approving or approved cultivated meat products. Singapore was the first in the world to approve cell-cultivated chicken back in 2018. And then the US followed a few years later with two different cultivated chicken products, which are now on the market there in a small way. Several other countries, Japan, South Korea, Israel, Switzerland, and soon Europe and the UK are following in their footsteps. So this is coming amazingly quickly. That's because consumers, regulators, policymakers know that cultivated meat's really important.
You say amazingly quickly, but you also use the phrase a couple of years. So is this going to take a couple of years before you're approved in the UK? And are you looking to other markets like Singapore to get this product kick-started in?
Yes and yes. So Our first target markets are Singapore and the US, because they're the right mix of commercial potential and regulatory speed. Our head of cell biology, who also leads all our regulatory work, is the man who got the world's first ever approval in Singapore, and then he did it again in the US. So we know really well how to get it right. They're much more established processes because it's been done before than in the UK. And we think in those countries, approval will take us about a year. In the UK, because nobody's been approved yet, there is a little bit more to work out. And that means it's likely we will be selling in the US and Singapore before we're able to sell in the UK. But selling in the UK is really important to us as a UK company, both because we want to make a difference here and we really care about British food security and flavour, but also because we have a big commercial advantage. We're based in London, so we should make the most of that advantage. The reality, though, is that we want to get to market as soon as possible. And that means initially, albeit with a product produced in London, we'll go to market abroad while we wait for our approval back here at home.
And have you got interested companies that want to buy this and are looking to? And are they established players, or are they people that are trying to build something new?
Everyone's interested. Everyone's desperate for better fat. When you speak to the people formulating meat alternatives, even just when you speak to chefs, no matter what they make, they're obsessed with fat. They know that it's the missing ingredient. In particular, it's what's stopping plant-based meat companies from making really good structured products. By structured products, I mean whole cuts of meat. Right now, there's quite a lot of mediocre sausages and burgers in the plant-based aisle in your supermarket, but there isn't steaks or pork belly or bacon, things which are whole cuts of an animal rather than a processed meat. The reason that those don't exist, the whole cuts, is because it's almost impossible to make them with plant-based fat. So that's one of the things that cultivated fat unlocks, and it's one of the drivers for huge customer interest across the board for us, whether it's small startups making really new kinds of plant-based meat or the massive established players who've been around even for decades. The good thing is that the big players, which is where we're focusing because they're the biggest customers, are mostly multinational. They produce and sell all over the world. So we can start with those customers selling products that we've co-developed abroad, and then we'll be able to bring the same products with the same customers and sell them in the UK as well.
HSBC Innovation Banking, our partner for this episode, provides commercial banking services, expertise, and insights to the technology, life science and healthcare, private equity, and venture capital industries. To find out why innovation needs different, go to www.hsbcinnovationbanking.com/en-gb. Doesn't the fact that you're introducing fat into a product make it less healthy? Because alongside the sustainability argument is also the argument that eating more plant-based food is better for our health. But if we're going back to animal fats, surely that's not going to be the case.
Great question. Animal fat is a complicated question when it comes to nutrition. The public health advice in, say, the 70s and 80s was that animal fats were best avoided. A lot of people switched as a result to plant-based or processed fats like margarine, rapeseed, palm oil. A lot of evidence is now suggesting that those seed oils in particular are really bad for your health. The reality is that the jury is out. There are people who are on zero-fat diets and then people who are on high-fat keto diets, and the nutritional science isn't yet conclusive. What we do know is twofold. Firstly, people eating either meat or meat alternatives are already eating fats. Fat is essential for making meat cook and sizzle the way that we want it to. So we're not proposing to increase the amount of fat. We're proposing to switch fats, which may not be very healthy, with our fat instead to make a better product. Our fat is healthier than most plant oils, in particular coconut oil, because it has much less saturated fat. And we also have the ability to make our fat healthier than its traditional counterpart, the fat that would come from a pig, for example. It's healthier for two reasons. Firstly, we can customize what's in it. For example, to reduce the saturated fat, or maybe to introduce really healthy fatty acids like omega-3s and 6s, which normally you'd have to get from fish or maybe from things like supplements. And secondly, are fats way safer than traditional meat as well? It has none of the nasties like antibiotics, none of the risk of contamination and disease, because it's produced in a really clean way. So fat is essential. Maybe fat is good for your health, maybe not, depends who you ask. But our fat is healthier than what it replaces in any case.
Now, let's talk a little bit about how you do this stuff. But before we do that, actually, one quick question about the costs, because I understand that like one of the biggest issues with lab-grown meat is that it's expensive to cultivate. And I guess that you're looking to bring costs down. So the methods that you use sounds, if they're very complex and probably therefore very expensive. Have you found a way of doing this sort of at scale and at a price that's sort of going to make it work?
Yes. Our obsession is cost and scale. We're making food. Food needs to be available on a massive scale if we want to make a difference and really change this industry of factory farming that feeds the world. And it also needs to be affordable for people to buy it. Our costs will come down as we scale up. There's a massive economies of scale. We're competing with a $1 trillion meat industry that's heavily subsidized by the government. But our ability to bring those costs down depends really heavily on the technology that we use, which is built from the ground up to make the process cheap. We've already made it many orders of magnitude cheaper than when we started a few years ago, and we'll continue to make it even cheaper as we scale to the point where our product will be at cost parity, will cost the same to produce as plant oils like coconut oil, and then eventually it will even cost less to make than traditional animal fat in a farm.
It does make sense, doesn't it, on an ever more crowded planet to not have fields and fields devoted to livestock. Now, you've got a 14,000 square foot facility in East London. So tell me a little bit about what goes on inside that. Well, let's get into the sort of science of how this works.
Yeah, for sure. So I would encourage you, Jane, to come and visit our wonderful facility. It's slap bang in the centre of town, and it's a really wonderful place to run our process. We're called Hoxton Farms. The irony there is we're a farm, but not the kind that you'd expect, and we're right in the middle of Hoxton. We think Hoxton is where meat should be produced, in the city where people eat it, not in the countryside where the environment is so sacred. Our process starts with a handful of cells, which we borrow from an animal like a pig or a cow. The cells are stem cells, which means that if we left them inside the animal, they would have turned into fat anyway. But instead, we take them into our facility and we put them in a cultivator, which you can think of as a lot like the kind of tank that you'd use to brew beer. Inside the cultivator, we convince the cells that they're still inside an animal. We heat them to body temperature and we provide them a nutritious mix of plant-based food, basically sugars and salts, amino acids and proteins. Those make the cells grow. And then eventually, just as they would have done inside the pig, we switch them to a high-fat diet and the cells start to mature into real fat tissue. The process takes about 3 weeks, and what we harvest at the end is real fat that looks a lot like what you'd buy from the butchers. It has the same consistency and color and smell. Under the microscope, it looks the same. It's fat tissue. It sizzles the same in a pan, and when we sell it to our customers and they use it to make meat alternatives, it performs the same as well. Right now, we're scaling up in this facility to be able to produce up to 100 kilograms a month of cultivated fat, which will produce over a ton of plant-based meat every month when we make the final formulation. But that's just the beginning. The plant-based meat industry is something like 5 million tons a year, if not more. And so this pilot facility allows us to prove the concept right here in London. And then once we've proven customer interest, that we can make it at cost and that we can get the product approved, we'll scale up to even bigger and start making hundreds of thousands of tons ourselves.
And I see on your website that this process is a combination of mathematical modeling and synthetic biology. Your background at Oxford University was partly involved in CRISPR, which is another slightly controversial technique of gene editing. Is CRISPR involved in this? And for people that might not have come across that term, do you want to explain what it is? And then also where maths modeling comes into it?
Yeah, for sure. So lots of complicated words there. Let me break it down. CRISPR is a way of changing the genes inside a cell, essentially switching them on or off. It's a faster version of what farmers do when they do selective breeding, which is finding, say, pigs with the right genes switched on and off and breeding them to kind of promote those genes. We can do that at the cellular level using this incredible technology called CRISPR instead. You're right, my technical background is using CRISPR to do gene editing. I did my PhD at Oxford using gene editing to modify cells and understand them from a clinical perspective. Back then, working in a hospital, I wasn't eating the cells, but I always wondered what they tasted like. And I realized that using some of this technology to make cultivated meat instead would give us an incredible set of tools for solving the problems. Now, that said, our first product is unlikely to be genome edited. It will have an unmodified genome. And that's because it's important to start with something simple from a regulatory perspective and from a safety perspective so that we can fully understand exactly how our product performs. And then we can steadily increase the technology to improve the quality of the product. But it's important to note that doing gene editing in food is approved in the UK. It's safe. It's already part of our food system. And it's something that broadly consumers are really accepting of. This is a long way away from the world of GMO, which was introducing genes from different species into the food that we eat. Taking a step back, though, from synthetic biology and genome editing, you're right, Jane, that our technology combines this world of cell biology with maths. As you mentioned before, ours is a complicated process. It's got lots of expensive inputs. There are lots of different steps in the facility, and we need to produce a cheap and scalable output at the end. Now, I'm just a humble biologist, but my co-founder, Ed, who's a North Londoner like me, one of my oldest childhood friends, is also a mathematician. And using maths is the way that we can take this really complicated process and make it cheap and scalable. It's a big data problem. So we've assembled an incredible team of mathematicians and computational biologists who build computer models that let us understand the process and optimize it to make it really, really cheap without having to do loads of experiments in the lab, which would be super expensive and slow. We can do those experiments in the computer instead and build an amazing process.
You mentioned that your co-founder is someone you've known, I think, since nursery, if I'm correct. What's it like working with somebody that you've known that long? Because, you know, entrepreneurial journeys are never easy, are they? And doing a journey like that with a very good friend, I should imagine, could be slightly fraught.
I think it's a huge privilege to have co-founded the company specifically with Ed, but in general with such a close friend. Running a company, like you said, is really difficult. It's a massive challenge, but a really rewarding one. And being able to share that challenge, but also all the achievements with someone who I know and trust so well, is amazing. Trust is such an important part of a business partnership. And there are lots of really successful co-founding pairs who've, you know, met each other a few months before they start a business. But for us, that trust comes built in because we know each other incredibly well. Our families know each other. We first met when we were 5 years old. And so that just makes the journey that much easier. And when it is difficult, we can lean on each other. So it's going really well.
And how about the funding? Because I should imagine building this lab factory in East London was not cheap. Have you had a lot of funding, a lot of backing? And is there more to come? Do you need a lot more?
We've raised about $25 million so far. And we've been able to make that go an extremely long way. But there is more of the journey remaining, and we will need to raise more money to keep scaling up our process. You're right, the R&D to build this kind of complicated process that nobody's ever done before is expensive. And so too is building the actual production infrastructure that we need. We raised our first seed round of venture capital investment in early 2021. That was about $3.5 million. The round was led by a prestigious Silicon Valley investor called Founders Fund. Their most recent London investment before they invested in Hoxton Farms was in a little company called DeepMind, which we all know well. Founders Fund have continued to be a really valuable partner on our journey. But in 2022, we added a few more really significant investors to the company by raising another $22 million. That round was co-led by a fund called Fine Structure Ventures, which is part of Fidelity, the huge asset manager, and another fund in New York called Collaborative Fund. We've still got plenty of money in the bank, which we're using to scale up our production here and work with more customers. But in order for us to build our next bigger industrial scale manufacturing facility, which may or may not be in Zone 1 in London, we'll see, we'll have to raise some more money. And we'll probably do that from a combination of VC investors, some new ones and some of our existing investors. And also we'll raise debt from banks or project finance lenders for the infrastructure we need to make.
It seems like quite a novel idea that you've come up with. Do you have any rivals in this space? Are there other people working on this same problem?
Yes, there are. And that's a good thing because it reminds me that we're not entirely crazy doing what we do. So there are quite a lot of cultivated meat companies across the world, broadly using a similar technology to ours, but they're making muscle meat instead of the fat that we specialize in. When it comes to specifically fat, there are a few companies around the world that also use stem cells, some of them from pigs, to make cultivated fat. And then there are other technologies for trying to improve upon plant oils like coconut oil instead. Those include using yeast to make fats or essentially doing chemistry to try to improve things like the melting temperature or the nutrition of plant oils. We really firmly believe that the only way to make convincingly delicious meat alternatives is to make real fat using stem cells the way that we do. And we think that we're by far the best at making that cultivated fat from stem cells. And the reason that we're the best at doing it is because we have the best technical team. We've got about 40 people here among the best and brightest scientists and engineers and culinary experts from all over the world. And combining this amazing power in machine learning with really, really great biology, we've been able to build a process that means our product is cheaper, tastier, and healthier than what anyone else can make. So we're such a young industry that I really see our competitors much more as collaborators, people working towards the same mission as us. And we're all very friendly and we share a lot with each other. But I also think Hoxton Farms is going to win when we get to market.
So what does the future hold? Finally, you did mention earlier that you might start using gene editing techniques in future. Would that improve the taste? Would that improve the scale? What would be the benefit of that? And in the more near-term future, what are your plans?
I'll start with the second question first. In the near-term future, our plans are scale. We're a B2B ingredients provider. That means we sell the ingredient to meat alternatives companies. We need to increase our production and bring down the costs so that we can sell even larger amounts of our ingredient to these meat alternatives companies, get the product approved and into people's kitchens and onto their plates so that they can taste meat alternatives containing cultivated fat and see just how awesome they are. That's what we need to do to scale up to industrial scale and really make a difference to the intensive animal agriculture industry by producing cultivated fat. There are lots of ways for us to make the technology even better, Jane. Firstly, right now we're focused on making pork back fat. But there are many other species of fat for us to make as well. There's delicious beef fat and chicken, even fish. And of course, we can make fat for different applications, not just meat alternatives. There's yogurt and bakery and confectionery, even cosmetics, outside food. All of these industries need fat. To enable us to do that even better and faster, we can definitely use gene editing, which lets us sensitively turn on and off genes inside cells to make them grow faster, which makes the process more scalable, or make them healthier, or change the taste. And we're learning now how to use AI to predict how changing the cells will affect the taste. And that means we can even come up with new flavors of fat that evolution hasn't invented yet. And to me, fundamentally, as a foodie, that's the most exciting and awesome thing we can possibly do. So it's really cool. Looking a little bit further into the medium term, what we're building is a platform for making absolutely anything with cells. I think biology is the most incredible tool for creating stuff. I mean, look around us at the planet, and we're learning how to use our platform to make anything cost-effectively and scalably, not just fat, not just food, but anything in cells. And when we unlock that platform, having proved it with cultivated fat, I think it's going to change the world.
It's really fascinating to talk to you. And I'm sort of coming round to the idea that I have to give this a go, really. So when you've got a burger ready and I'm allowed to eat it, regard me as one of your first customers.
It's a deal.
But Max, that's all we've got time for. Thank you so much for joining me on the UKTM podcast today. We will be back with another episode next week. But in the meantime, you can keep up to date with all the latest UK tech developments at www.uktech.news. Don't forget to follow UKTN on LinkedIn and X, where you can also get in touch with me at Jane Wakefield with your comments and suggestions about the show. Until next time, goodbye from me. This podcast is brought to you by HSBC Innovation Banking, the power behind the UK's forward thinkers, future makers and leap takers. They're helping to ignite the bold ideas that reshape our world. Go to www.hsbcinnovationbanking.com/en-gb to find out how innovation needs different.